We were recently up in the very tip of Michigan, right up there. We're swimming on a beach up there. And I was looking at Jenny, my daughter, and noticed that her hair was standing out straight, just like this. It looked like she had her hand on a Van de Graaff generator. And I, you know, that's weird. How'd you do that? And then I looked, and she was holding her daughter, and her daughter's hair was doing that, too. And she looked at my hair was doing that too. And then we looked around and all the swimmers in that area, the hair was just standing on end. And then we looked up and heard the rumbling of approaching thunderstorm and got the heck out of the lake fast. And the standing of the hair on end, if you don't know that, is a pretty good sign of approaching lightning. And if you're hiking up in the hills up here and you see your hair doing that, you want to find a ditch to get down in right away. Because it's a pretty good sign of something is about to happen and it's going to be pretty powerful. And you want to be ready. Well, Jesus is coming. Are you ready? When was the last time you heard somebody say, "I think he's coming soon"? I don't know about you, but I hear this all over the place. As I experience going through different Christian circles and talk with people, you know, various parts of the country and here locally, I see our collective hair standing on end. Jesus is coming. I don't know when, but I genuinely believe soon. That's not a prophecy. That's just a hunch. You know, and I see this all over the place. I don't know whether, you know, some people would say, well, that's because of the Left Behind series of novels that awakened interest in this, the second coming of Jesus. I think the Left Behind series took off because of the heightened expectation. Some people would attribute it to world events, particularly as they surround Jerusalem. And yet world events have signaled the possibility of the approach of Christ many times. And yet there is something in the air right now that makes me ask the question, is it going to be soon? But a more relevant question for each of us, because we know he's coming, it's not a question of if, it's a question of when. And it's not really even a question of when. It's a question, most relevantly, for each of us, are you ready? Are you ready? If he came this afternoon, you ready? I'm convinced that being ready has nothing to do with anything I do. In its most basic form. You know, ultimately, it's the work of Jesus Christ on the cross that makes me qualified as having, you know, surrendered to that and accepted that and accepted him in my life, as John was talking about before. That makes me qualified to be safe and to be gathered, to be recognized by Christ when he comes. But Jesus still talks about being ready, being alert, watching for the signs. And if you think about, I can understand this idea of being ready, but what does it take to be ready? And there's no shortage of people who want to tell you what it takes to be ready. The things that you ought to do, or the things you ought to think, or the things that you ought to be, or all this kind of thing. And there's, you know, competing voices. You know, it's going to happen this way, it's going to happen that way. First we got to do this, and all this kind of stuff. Who do you listen to? As I ask that question in my own heart, I ask it sincerely because I recognize from reading the New Testament that the first time Jesus came, I might not have been ready. I don't think I would have been. I think I would have been with the majority of people who missed it the first time he came. That's just my own reflection on the kind of person I am inside and the tendencies and struggles that I have in my own heart and the kinds of things that I trust and the kinds of things I am suspicious of and so forth. But I really, you know, I wonder if I would have been ready the first time. And that makes me wonder if when he comes the second time, whether I'll be escaping as someone through the flames or whether I'll be ready. Be ready. And if you ask the question, well, who do you listen to? It might be instructive to go back and say, well, okay, who did they listen to the first time? And who was really telling them the right stuff and who was not? What kind of teaching was relevant and effective in making people ready the first time? And what was not relevant and effective the first time? There was a heightened expectation before Jesus came the first time, just like there is now. I don't know whether perhaps somebody worked out the math from the book of Daniel and knew that it had to happen within the next few years. I don't know exactly why, but I do know that there was a heightened sense of expectation. I think it was the Holy Spirit myself. I think it was their hair standing on end, getting ready for something powerful to happen. Regardless of how it was, people were talking about the Messiah will be coming. False messiahs were showing up and taking advantage of this heightened expectation. And there was a lot of teaching going back and forth about how to be ready and what to do, what you needed to know, and so forth. Well, who was right? What kind of teaching proved to be powerful and effective and relevant in making people ready? I think you'll see as we read this next passage, two basic kinds of teaching, two basic kinds of religious influence. Now, this was John's testimony. Are you confused by the word John in here? It's never John the Apostle. John the Apostle, who wrote this book, never calls himself John. It's almost always John the Baptist. Sometimes it's when he's talking to an apostle, he refers to him as a son of John, which is a different John, but never John the Apostle, so don't be confused. Now, this was John. Who? The Baptist. Testimony when the Jews of Jerusalem sent priests and Levites to ask him who he was. He did not fail to confess, but he confessed freely, I'm not the Christ. They asked him, well then, who are you? Are you Elijah? He said, I am not. Are you the prophet? He answered, no. Finally, they said, well, who are you? Give us an answer to take back to those who sent us. What do you say about yourself? And John replied in the words of Isaiah, the prophet, I am the voice of one calling in the desert. Make straight the way for the Lord. Now, some Pharisees who had been sent questioned him. Why then do you baptize if you're not the Christ, nor Elijah, nor the prophet? I baptize with water. John replied, but among you stands one you do not know. He is the one who comes after me, the thongs of whose sandals I am not worthy to untie. And all this happened at Bethany on the other side of the Jordan where John was baptizing. Now, if you look at this, and I encourage you to keep this open, and we're going to skip around in this passage and kind of, you know, look at it thematically back and forth. So just keep your eye on that. If you look at this, there's two different kinds of influence going on here. The first one is a group of guys that the apostle calls the Jews. Now, John uses this term, the Jews, about 70 times in this book. And he's not always talking about the same people, but usually he's talking about those who resisted Christ for various reasons. It's not an anti-Semitic thing. John was Jewish. He uses this as kind of a catchphrase for those who oppose Jesus, and you have to use the context to figure out, well, who he's talking about. In this case, he's talking about officials, people of influence and clout, who sent a delegation of priests and Levites to interrogate John the Baptist, find out if he was doctrinally correct. Okay? Well, this was a kind of a self-appointed human group of mucky mucks. How do I know that? Well, what's the group that they sent? It's priests and Levites. If they were using God's system of order, the priests and Levites would have been in charge and would have been doing the sending. Some human-derived authorities had pulled themselves together and were exercising their clout, their human influence, their prestige. I don't know, maybe their wealth. I don't know what it was. Perhaps there were some priests in that group, probably were, but their influence derived from their position in humanity, among humans, among people. And they used that clout to get the priests and Levites to do their dirty work. They gathered the clergy together, and they said, now you go down there and you interview John, and you get to the bottom of this, and you come back and you tell us what happened. And if you notice, this group of priests who should have been in charge were afraid to go back without the right answers. When John said, no, I'm not him, not him, no, nope, nope, you got it wrong. They said, you better tell us something so when we go back, we've got something to say. So you can kind of picture this group that John calls the Jews in the background. They're exercising a lot of clout. And they've got some threat behind that clout. And and because there's a whole group of them, you can kind of sense that they're taking their cues from each other. They're, do you agree with this? Do you agree with that? Now we're all together. Now we've got the power to do this. And what we're talking about here is an authority that gets its authority from people, from the consensus of the people. It's a kind of influence that operates with a sense of superiority because of their position among men. You see that? Maybe you can recognize some of these kinds of influences in our day in the church. They exist. It's just, it's pesky humans. We do this. But it's an authority that comes with a sense of superiority because of its position among men. And it's a group of people who, through their own study and interpretation, have got all the answers worked out. They've got all the T's crossed, all the I's dotted in their theology. They've got a whole system worked out so they know what God has to do. If God's going to send a Messiah, he's going to have to do this, this, and this. And they know it, and they've got it all figured out. They've written a book. Maybe they got a series of novels. I don't know. But they've got it all worked out. They've got all the answers. That's one group of influence. On the other side, you've got one solitary man. He hasn't got, he doesn't really care if anybody else agrees with him. He hasn't got any position or prestige or clout. He's operating not out of sense of superiority, but a profound sense of humility. Not because of his position among men, but because of his position before God. John the Baptist is absolutely riveted by the fact that he has been chosen by Almighty God to prepare the way for his Messiah. Two different, radically different approaches here. And John the Baptist isn't all that concerned with having the right answers either. Matter of fact, he's missed some of the answers. He said, when they asked him, are you Elijah? He said, no. Apparently, he was not aware, as Jesus taught later, that he was Elijah. He was the fulfillment of that prophecy. That in Malachi, it says that the spirit of Elijah will come before the Messiah. And John didn't realize that's how he was being used. And I'm comfortable with that because I'm convinced that most of the time, we're used most powerfully when we're not aware of how we're being used. But he didn't care about having the right answers, so to speak. John's main focus was on what God had told him to do. One group has all the answers, so they know what God has to do. If God's not going to do it this way, it's not going to be legit. The other guy has some of the right answers, but not all concerned with that. What his main focus is on what God has told him to do. I wonder sometimes if we humans got a committee together to figure out how to solve the problem of atheism and communism in the former Soviet Union, what we would have done. But God did it. As Leif said this morning, God's plan is being accomplished. Well, this is the way John was operating. He kept his eye on God and not on people. And he didn't much care if you agreed with him or not. He told what God told him to tell. He said, look, it's not about me. I'm not the Messiah. I'm not Elijah. I'm not the prophet. Once John says, look, all I am is a voice. It's not about me. I'm a voice. We'll get back to that in a second. But this other group, the mucky mucks, they've sent another group down of Pharisees. What are they doing there? Now, this is the original language is a little confusing on this, but the best interpretation, it seems to me, is that you got the group of priests and Levites who have gone down to interrogate John, and then you got this other group of Pharisees who are known for their strenuous obedience to every detail of the law, and they've come flocking down to watch the priests and the Levites do this interrogation so that if they get it wrong or if they get stumped or something, then the Pharisees can jump in and... And as soon as John comes back with something that's not on the political, correct grid, he says, I'm not this guy, I'm not this guy, I'm not this guy. And then they say, well, who are you? And he says, he answers from a prophetic point of view from Isaiah. The Pharisees get all bent out of shape. Who gives you the authority to baptize people? You see that tendency of human-derived power? It's all about me. It's, who gives you, who I am. Who gives you the right to yabba yabba? And in this case, they got bent out of shape because the baptism wasn't new for Jews. They were baptizing all the time, but they only baptized Gentiles who wanted to become Jews. That was their way of cleansing them from all the corruption of the Gentile world. Well, John came baptizing Jews and Gentiles. Didn't make any difference. Prepare them for the coming Messiah. Who gives you the right to do that? And John said, it's not about the water. It's about knowing the one who's coming, the one who's here. He's standing right with you. John said, I'm just a voice. That's all I am. Do you know the name Duncan Wells? Duncan Wells, I'll bet you know his voice. How many know Duncan Wells, who he is? Nobody. I'll bet you if I played a tape of his voice, how many have heard that voice? All the hands would go up, because he's one of the most familiar voices on the planet. He's a British guy who's a voice. That's all he is. He's a public voice. They send him a script. He reads it word for word. Sends it back. He's being wired up right now to prepare him to change the voice on Stephen Hawking's computerized voice. You know about Stephen Hawking, the quantum mechanics guy, the brainy but paralyzed man who speaks through a robotic voice. They've wired up Duncan Wells with this nice melodious British voice, and they've got his collar on to measure his voice and do all this stuff so that they can do the software necessary to put his voice into Stephen Hawking's outfit. So when Steve answers a question, all of a sudden he's this British guy. But Duncan Wells is just a voice. When Steve Hawking uses his voice, Duncan Wells does not have to be a competent scientist. Steve does. John didn't have to know the answers. All he had to know was what God told him to say. Because he was a voice. Do you see, as you ask the question, well, who do I listen to be ready for Christ's second coming? Do you see that there is one approach to this that has everything to do with the authority of the person? And they cluster together and they get all their theological T's crossed and their I's dotted and they operate out of a sense of superiority because of their standing among men. And there's another approach that's absolutely humble. It's nothing about who they are. It's all about Jesus. And the only thing they know is what God has told them to say. Now, I'm not running down scholarship. Not a bit. I'm talking about the attitude of the heart. I think one of the most profound scholars on the globe today is John Stott. But if you ever listen to John Stott in person, he came and spoke at Denver Seminary when I was there. I was absolutely moved by how humble a man he is. And the only thing he knows is what God has told him to say. I mean, he thinks a lot of stuff, and he's studied a lot of stuff, and he has a lot of T's crossed, but he's not dogmatic. He's humble. He's not operating out superiority. He's operating out humility. And he's watching and listening and paying attention to God, like John the Baptist. When it comes to evaluating styles of teaching, keep that in mind. Is it about the teacher or is it about Jesus? Enough said about that, but what did John say? What was his message? What did God tell him to say? He said, well, I'm the voice of one crying in the wilderness, saying, prepare the way for the Lord. And if you move on to verse 26, he says, among you stands one you do not know. John says, if we can paraphrase this and summarize it, he says, if you want to be ready for the coming of the Messiah, if you want to know him, make the road ready. Now, he said that the Word became flesh and came and made his tent among us. God is coming to you. Religion is about you going to God. Jesus is about him coming to you. And our part of that is to prepare the road. Make it straight. Or perhaps using the idiom of the Greek a little bit more literally, or the Hebrew. This comes from a prophet named Isaiah. Prepare the way. A voice crying in the wilderness. The wilderness is a desolate place that won't grow vegetation. That same word can be used for a flock of sheep who have no shepherd. And he said, prepare the way. And the idiom can mean clear the rocks out of the road. Grade it. Make it straight. And if you have this image of Jesus coming to you along the road, you want to take everything out of the road that might impede his progress to coming all the way to and in your heart. That's the deal. How many rocks are on the path that Jesus has to walk to get to your heart and into it? As a non-believer, had all kinds of rocks in my road. I had pride, I had fun, I had doubt, I had drugs, I had money, I had suspicion, I had prejudice, all kinds of rocks. And if you could have seen Jesus trying to get to me, staggering and stumbling. John says, you want to be ready, you clear those rocks away. Several times I'll be talking to somebody about a problem in their life or something, and it occurs to me, you know what? They don't know who Jesus is. They have not figured this out. And I'll explain the gospel. And sometimes at the end of that conversation, I'll say, does this make sense to you? Yeah, it really does. Do you have any questions? No. And I said, well, what would be in the way if I asked you if you wanted to pray and accept Jesus right now, what would be in the way? And then they spot the rocks. Then they come back, you know, they back off and say, wait a minute. And then they start asking real questions about real rocks in the road. And the process at that point, as you know, is to help them examine, well, does that rock need to be in your road? Or can you, do you have the guts and the insight to take that and move it off the road and let Jesus have a clear path to your heart? And my guess is the size of the congregation here this morning, there's somebody I'm talking to who's got rocks that are still in the road that have prevented them from surrendering to Jesus. And first and foremost, my friend, you need to understand that if you want to be ready when he comes back, that's the first step. You need to have accepted him and surrendered to him and allowed him by his blood shed on the cross to wash you clean, and by his life, his resurrected life, to give you the life of God in your heart by which you can begin to grow into this permanent, eternal relationship with God called eternal life. And if there's anything in the path, I urge you, clear it away. Make straight the road for the Lord. But then as I reflect about my own life, I've been a believer for a number of years now, I recognize that as I look at the path of the relationship between me and my Lord, every once in a while I'll spot a rock in that road. And I know how it got there, too. I snuck out and put it back there one night because I thought it needed to be there. Sometimes it's a rock of money. Sometimes it's a rock of fear. I don't know what the rocks are in your life, but I know this. If you want to be ready, keep that road straight. Keep that road clear. You know, your relationship with Jesus is a lot like a marriage. The relationship develops and grows until a point where you come to a crisis and you say, yes, I do, I surrender. Bam, then you're married. Okay? Then the fun begins, right? And that relationship is dynamic. It needs to be constantly worked on. The rocks need to be constantly cleared away to keep that relationship. And my friend, if you want to be ready for Jesus, you can't earn it by clearing away the rocks. But if you want to be really ready, if you want to be glad when you see his face, keep that road clear. Make that way straight. That's what it takes.